Well, what are the odds required to form a universe by chance, which features just the right geometry, the right genetics, the right geology to sustain life? What are the odds? Up next, Dr. Robert Piccioni joins us as we talk about, can life be merely an accident? Dr. Robert Piccioni graduated from Caltech, has a PhD in high energy physics from Stanford University, and was on the research faculty of Harvard. He ran a number of startup and turnaround high-tech companies, making medical, microelectronic equipment. He holds several patents for medical, microelectronic, and several energy devices as well. And here he is back on Coast to Coast. Hey, Robert, how are you? Good morning.
I'm doing great, George. How are you?
Super, super. Life is good.
Oh, life is great.
You know what?
And it's not merely an accident.
It's as good as we want it to be, isn't it?
Oh, hey, I agree with that. Absolutely.
And you're right. I don't think it is an accident at all. Tell me, when you started looking at this, Robert, to answer that question, can life be merely an accident? How did you come upon it?
Well, I was on the show before, and we talked about the first book I wrote, which was Everyone's Guide to Atoms, Einstein, and the Universe.
Mm-hmm.
And when I was writing that book, I had to go back and, you know, review the basic physics that I hadn't looked at for 30 years because I was working on other things. And I saw that this little thing, this little aspect of the universe had to be a certain way for life to exist. Yeah, we all know that. This little thing has to be that way. And all these many things had to be just perfectly tuned. And when I put them all together in my mind, I was just astonished at how many of them there were and how unlikely each of these things were to occur by accident. And it was really amazing to me.
And they were all so important to the puzzle, weren't they?
Yeah, they're all absolutely essential. You know, this really started with Einstein. He said once, I think it was near the end of his life, he said, "What really interests me is whether God had any choices when he made the universe." And I think what Einstein meant was, do the laws of physics and math require that the universe be more or less exactly as it is? Or could it have been radically different? And I guess if he had found out that it could have been radically different, his next question would have been, why did God choose this one? And, you know, now 50 years later, science has learned so much more than we knew when Einstein was alive. And we now know that there are 20 knobs, if you will, 20 adjustable values that determine what a universe is going to be like. So you could think of each of these knobs as being like the temperature setting on your oven or, you know, the cooking time and other stuff. And so if you wanted to bake a cake, you'd adjust the knobs to your favorite recipe and push the enter button or something, and that would pop a cake, right?
Are scientists, physicists still baffled at how this all happened?
Oh, if they think about it, they are, yeah. I think a lot of scientists never worry about this. They, you know, they just go around working on their experiment and so on, and they don't really look at the big picture because, you know, one of the things about our society is we all get focused on such a narrow specialty. We get to be very expert at almost nothing. And so that's particularly true in science, that, you know, each scientist is really very clever at a very small thing. And hopefully all of those things work together, but that's someone else's job.
Well, you know, if science tries to figure it out, I think it can't get the answers right now. They're not there.
We're still missing stuff, huh?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. But you're right. When you look at all these factors, the odds are just astronomical.
Yeah. So, for instance, one of the knobs is the mass of the proton. Now, everything around us is made of atoms, and the most important part of an atom is the nucleus, and the most important part of that is the proton. So protons are, you know, essential to life, because without protons, no atoms.
Mm-hmm.
Well, if the mass of the proton was 0.25% more than it happens to be, then it would be unstable, and atoms wouldn't exist. It would immediately disintegrate, no atoms. And if it was 0.25% less, then stars wouldn't be able to produce energy. And if there's no stars producing energy, there wouldn't be any life on Earth. So that mass of the proton has to be very close to the value that it happens to be in our universe, but it could have been almost anything else. All the laws of physics and math would be perfectly happy if the mass of the proton was twice as much or half as much or 10 times as much. You know, we don't know why it's that value, but we do know that if it wasn't exactly that value, we wouldn't exist. That's one of the 20 knobs. There's 19 more.
You talk about four basic groups for requirements of life. You want to go through them?
Yeah. We need to have a viable universe. We need a universe with the right sort of geometry. It has to be stable, and it has to produce stars. That's the first.
We got that.
We got that. But that's the 20 knobs. It could have been, the universe could have been entirely different, and it could have been completely unsurvivable.
Mm-hmm.
The next thing was we need the atoms that everything around us that's material is made of. And particularly, we need the right type of atoms for life. And those are special. Those atoms took billions of years to be created in our own universe, and they are among the rarest things in the universe. And then the next thing you need, the third thing, is you need to have some sort of a viable habitat for life to arise in, something like the Earth. I mean, mm-hmm. It could be some other planet. It could be some other sort of place, but it has to be basically as good as the Earth for life to survive. I mean, we can't survive on probably 80% of the planet.
Well, you know, I think of that poor mountain climber who fell into Mount St. Helens.
Yeah.
You know, he was backing up for a picture, and, you know, the crisp broke down, and down he went. Mm. And, had they been able to get to him earlier, he would have been okay. He would have survived.
Mm-hmm.
But they couldn't, and, you know, the elements got him. So,
right.
You know, you look at that and you say, on this planet, we can die if we're in just the wrong environment, just on this planet. So
sure.
When you look at how these other planets have to be, they have to be very similar to planet Earth.
They have to be very, very special. Absolutely. I mean, we can't live in the ocean. You know, how long could you live in the ocean? An hour?
Right.
I mean, you can't live in the desert. You can't live on the North Pole or the South Pole. If you really think about it, you know, there's only a small fraction of this is the best place in the whole universe for life.
We had 5 degrees in St. Louis when I was back there in the winter. 5 degrees.
Yeah.
You know, if it were about 40 more degrees colder, we couldn't make it.
Yeah.
You know, we'd run out of natural gas. Who knows what would happen,
yeah.
But we couldn't make it. So we're pretty darn lucky. Now, for that to happen, I would think then, as you believe, other planets have to be pretty darn similar to what we've got here, right?
I think they have to be, yes, I think they have to be similar to Earth. They have to be remarkably special, just like Earth is remarkably special.
Temperature's pretty close,
yeah.
Water, everything.
Earth is not just the best of the 8 planets, you know, 8 now that Pluto's been demoted. It's not just the best of the 8. It's probably the best of a billion planets.
Yeah, I think you may be right. But it's not the only planet.
No, because there are billions and billions and billions of planets,
yep,
out there. So, you know, there's some. But the idea that there's another one just around the corner, I don't think that's right. I think that you would have to look long and hard to find one that's as good as the Earth is.
I think you're right. So that was the 3. What about the 4th area?
Well, the 4th thing is actually the most demanding of all. And that is, you need a genetic code that defines what life is, something like our DNA.
Mm-hmm.
And it turns out that DNA is the most sophisticated, the most complex, the most beautifully organized thing in the entire universe. There is nothing as sophisticated and delicate in its design as DNA.
Is it like a symphony?
Oh, it's a the greatest work of art there is.
Yeah.
You know.
Just happened by random, right?
Well, you know, I did the math. We can talk about the math.
Yeah.
No way is it random, yeah. So there are as many atoms in every copy of our DNA as there are stars in a galaxy. And, you know, we have like 10 trillion cells in our body, and every one of them's got a complete set of human DNA. And your DNA and my DNA and every other person's DNA is about 99.9% the same. But anyway, it's got 3.2 2 billion symbols in it. If you wrote it out like the Encyclopedia Britannica, you'd have 1,500 volumes that say, what's George Norrie?
Yeah.
It's incredible. And, you know, the difference is if you take a galaxy and you take 10% of the stars on the left and you switch them with 10% of the stars on the right, who cares? I mean, the galaxy keeps spinning. But you start mucking around with where the atoms are in human DNA, and pretty soon you kill somebody. It's really got to be just the way it is. I mean, it can't be much different. It's just incredible how sophisticated that design is.
If for some reason there was all chance here,
mm-hmm.
let's just look at it from that possibility,
mm-hmm.
all chance, what would the odds be?
Well,
zillion.
Probably. Yeah. It's there's no illion in the human in the English language that'll tell you how many zeros that has to be. It's just incredible. But I have a way of translating it into a number that is easier to wrap your mind around.
All right.
If you were to take human DNA, which has these 3.2 billion base pairs, and you scrambled up 3.2 billion base pairs and you said, okay, now is that a human being? Or let's say, is that George Norrie, right? A specific human being.
You might be able to make me with a few of them.
The odds of making George Norrie are the same as drawing the ace of spades from a deck of cards 1 billion times in a row.
Oh.
1 billion times in a row. So, I mean, it's like if you had a billion decks of cards on the table.
And you just reach in and grab one, right?
You reach in and grab one from each deck.
It's going to be an ace.
And they all have to be the ace of spades.
Not going to happen.
No. Now, let's say we weren't going to say it had to be George Norrie. Let's say we'd be happy if it was the DNA of any human being that had ever walked the surface of the earth.
Okay. What are those odds?
You save six draws of the ace of spades. It's 999,999,994 draws.
Not going to happen?
No, that's how unlikely it is to get any human being. Okay, so humans are obviously pretty complicated.
And unique.
So let's take the smallest, slimiest, little humblest bacteria. The living creature that has the least DNA and is the least complicated of all. If you were to try to duplicate that creature, you'd still be less likely to do that by accident than drawing the ace of spades 120,000 times in a row.
Why don't other scientists who don't believe in intelligent design, we'll get into that,
mm-hmm.
why don't they look at it that way?
Well, you know, this whole thing is a combination of many different disciplines. I mean, I all the things I talked about so far, you know, they include astrophysics, particle physics, cosmology, quantum mechanics, genetics, chemistry. And science just isn't organized to put all those things together so often. I mean, everybody's got their little specialty that they're very good at. And, you know, when I was working as a scientist, I would never have been able to do this because I was too busy with my little piece. You know, everybody's got to make a living, and that's how you make a living in science, is you've got to be really good. You've got to be the best there is at that little piece.
That's right.
And you can't be the best there is in the world at everything. All you can hope to do is be the best at one little thing. So we don't synthesize things. We dissect them. And I don't think anybody has looked at the overall picture.
All right, so let's now do the reverse. Let's now assume all of this was by some kind of design. We won't even get into what kind of design at this point, but mm-hmm. we'll get there later.
Mm-hmm.
But some kind of design created all this.
Mm-hmm.
You've just demonstrated, and as far as I'm concerned, you've just proven how this couldn't happen by chance.
Right.
It's too astronomical.
Right.
So now we take the intelligent design concept, or is there another form of how this was developed that is not chance, that is not intelligent design? Is there something else out there that I'm missing?
Well, there may be, but none of us knows what it is.
Okay.
So there may be some natural mechanism, which has got nothing to do with divine power, which just happens to put all these nucleotide base pairs in the right sequence, but no one's got a clue what that is.
Almost like when you cut your finger, your skin grows back, and it grows back almost the same way as it was.
Right.
So there could be something in this universe that does that.
Right. You know, I mean, science has had problems in the, you know, science has had lots of unanswered problems in the past. And sometimes what's happened is that we come up with a great discovery and we learn something that no one ever expected. And all of a sudden these great mysteries are resolved. And everybody says, oh, yeah, that makes sense. But sometimes those questions don't get answered. And this is one of the questions that hasn't been answered yet. People have been asking this question for an awfully long time, maybe since the beginning of time. And we still don't know the answer. Now, a lot of scientists think they know the answer. In fact, almost all scientists, including me until very recently, believed that, you know, this was not a big problem, that, you know, carbon atoms banged into nitrogen atoms and all that stuff, and, you know, eventually it happened.
Well, and it even gets even more perplexing, Robert, when you think of, for example, our solar system.
Mm-hmm.
For us to exist the way we are,
mm-hmm.
we needed the moon to be where it is. For us to exist the way we are and protect us, for example, from asteroids and incoming comets, we needed Jupiter
yes.
to be the way it was.
Yes.
I mean, what are the odds of all that happening?
Well, I think they're less than one in a billion, but you know, no one knows the number because we haven't seen a billion planets.
No.
But, you know, the moon was created from the Earth
yep.
by this cataclysmic collision. I mean, that probably doesn't happen all that often in just that right way. And that collision gave us the moon, which you just described. The moon maintains the rotational axis of the Earth, so we have consistent seasons. Life couldn't exist without that. That collision also created an immense amount of molten iron in the center of the Earth. The Earth got the iron from both of these colliding bodies, and the moon basically got the crust of the Earth. So
they got the junk part.
Well, yeah, but you know, the crust of the Earth is the continent that we all live on, so we need to keep some of it.
Yeah.
Yeah. But, you know, without that molten iron, we wouldn't have a magnetic field. Without the magnetic field, the atmosphere would be stripped away by the solar wind. So there's a whole bunch of things that just had to happen exactly the right way.
It is remarkable.
Or we wouldn't be here.
It is truly remarkable.
I mean, I think it's the most fascinating story I know.
So when we come back from the break, let's look at it from the intelligent design concept. But let's try to get your thoughts on what you think that is. I'm just very curious. Meanwhile, Can Life Be Merely an Accident? Great book, easy to read. Where do you get it?
Well, I have a toll-free number, 877-COSMOS-2. That's 877-COSMOS-2. Or you can go to my website, guidetothecosmos.com.
Perfect. Can life be merely an accident? What do you think? So we're going to talk with Robert Piccioni about that even more when we come back on Coast to Coast AM. Next hour, we'll open up the phone lines. It's Fast Night tonight, floating format with basically two separate shows that are somewhat related as we talk about life with Ken Klein and we talk about life with Robert Piccioni as well. But the thoughts of intelligent design now, and that's what we're going to get in when we come back in a moment. As he said, probably one of the greatest stories you'll ever hear. We'll be back. Okay, next hour we'll open up the phone lines and take some questions with Robert Piccioni. And yes, the Skype line is up and running for you as well. We'll do that next hour on Coast to Coast AM. So now we get to the big question. If there's intelligent design here, what is it, Robert?
Well, you know, that's the great unanswered question. Let me tell you some of the things that other scientists have thought about, and then we can sort of segue into what I think. Most scientists have the view that life was created without any divine intervention, just by the existing laws of chemistry and physics.
They think your odds that you pointed out before the break are what happened, basically.
Yeah. Okay. So that point of view is sort of epitomized by the statement of George Wald, who was professor of biology at Harvard and a winner of the Nobel Prize, so a man of great esteem. And he said that time itself performs the miracles, that given enough time, the improbable becomes probable, the impossible becomes possible, and the unlikely becomes a fact. And I think that most scientists believe that, but they don't believe it for any because there's specific evidence. They just believe it as sort of an article of faith, if you will. That's the faith of science.
Mm-hmm.
And to be quite honest, that's what I believed for almost my whole life until I actually sat down and did some math. And the only reason I did was I had this long, drawn-out discussion at happy hour with one of my good friends who's a very religious guy. And we were talking about the origin of life, and I just recited the common wisdom of science. And, you know, he expressed the point of view of his faith. And, you know, we didn't sell anything, but we had a good time at happy hour. And then, you know, years later, I kept thinking about that. And then I actually went and did the math. And, you know, that's when my whole idea of this completely changed. I mean, it's not even close. It's just ridiculously impossible. Now, there are a few scientists who agree with me. One is Francis Crick, who won the Nobel Prize for discovering the structure of DNA, so he's no slouch. And another is Sir Fred Hoyle, who's a famous British astrophysicist, now deceased. And Fred Hoyle was most famous for being the guy who invented the term Big Bang.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
Yeah, and Fred said that the probability of life occurring by accident is about as likely as assembling a 747 by having a tornado go through a junkyard. So that's pretty poetic, but I did a little math. I think the 747 is actually a little more difficult. At least it's more difficult than the bacteria. But the point is that no one did the math, and I think the reason is they didn't know how many times these molecules actually banged into each other. So that stopped them from doing the calculation. They just said, well, it has to work out. And my approach was a little bit different. I said, I don't have to know how many times they actually banged into each other. I can figure out a maximum number, a number that's so wildly optimistic that the reality has to be less than that. And if I can show that even this maximum number is insufficient to allow the existence of life, then it doesn't matter what the actual number was.
All right.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, you sure?
Yeah, I mean, so what I did is I said, let's take all the carbon atoms in the universe and let's turn them into DNA base pairs. And let's say they were interacting a billion times a second, which they can't do because they can't move that fast. And let's say they did that from the moment of the Big Bang until today, and that's all the time that there is. So that's, and you know, that is a astronomically optimistic number because
that's pushing it, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, even in our own body, only 1/1000th of the carbon atoms are in DNA. And, you know, if you look at the Earth, only a small fraction of carbon is actually in living things. So, you know, all these, I've overstated everything to get a wildly optimistic number. But that number is incredibly too small compared to what life has to have. The entire universe could have only generated one molecule at one point in its history, at one point in its vast expanse of space. One molecule with 230 base pairs, and the simplest form of life has got 500,000. I mean, you're nowhere close. And if you wanted 231 base pairs, the universe would have to be three times older. And if you wanted 232 base pairs, it would have to be 10 times older. I mean, you're never going to make it.
So how did it start?
Well, so, you know, that is the unanswered question, and my view is I want to be the guide that takes people to the top of the mountain and shows them the beautiful view. And when we get to the top of the mountain, I don't have to tell you what you're looking at. You're going to see it.
Yeah, but what if one person says to you, Professor, this is gorgeous. How did it get here?
Well, I don't know. I don't know. You know, it's. I can think of only two possibilities, and I think that they're both entirely respectable answers.
All right, they are?
Yeah, and one is that God created life, some supernatural entity. You might as well call it God.
All right.
And the other is that there is this unknown mechanism, which we haven't discovered yet, which has this incredible capacity to put all these things, all these DNA base pairs in the right sequence.
Somewhere along the line, through all this, there's also, I think, another question that needs to be answered by science, and that is, what the heck are we? There's got to be, beyond just looking at the universe, beyond looking at the solar system and the galaxies and the planets and everything else, we come down to us.
Yeah.
And here we are, living, breathing, spiritual beings, thinking beings. You know, here we are, we're on this radio show right now, 527 stations, we're all over the world. You're talking, I'm talking in the wee hours.
Well, you're a miracle, George. There's no question about it.
I'm not so sure about that. But what are we? Well, you've got to add that into the equation.
Yeah. Well, let me add one last thing to the previous question that I think is important for me to say, and that is that I am really offended by the fact that there's so many scientists that are bad-mouthing faith.
Yeah.
They have no justification. I mean, I read these things in scientific journals. There's no place for that in science, and there's no place for that in the public. I mean, they can believe what they want to believe, and they ought to let other people believe what they want to
without putting them down.
And there's no evidence, no more evidence for their point of view than any other point of view.
That's right.
Right. I mean, they're just being, you know.
If anything, the other point of view, that of a divine creation, I think is more acceptable, given the fact that just the odds you pointed out are so astronomical that you know, scientists as mathematicians or experts in probability should say, he's right, there's no way this could happen by an accident.
Right. And the least I'd like to accomplish here is I'd like to, you know, to have scientists stop having this battle against people of faith because they have a different point of view. I mean, I think that that's just awful.
Well, but through the question of who are we, because
who are we? Okay.
we're part of this, and there's also another one.
Yes.
Which is even more of a paradox, and that is, how did it all start? I mean, I still can't comprehend how something can start from nothing. You know, that even if we talk about God, okay, I was raised a Catholic, I'm extremely spiritual. How did it, being God, how did it start? Somebody had to form it. I mean, it just, as my mother used to say, George, there's no answer. Always was, always will be. I said, Mom, I want the answer. She said, no,
well,
you're not going to get it.
Since you grew up and since I grew up, we have learned that it wasn't always as it is now and always will be. That was a point of view that a lot of people had, just what your mother said. And it was a point of view that Einstein had. So I'm not knocking your mom.
No, I know that.
But since then, we discovered that the universe indeed had a beginning, so it wasn't always there, and it won't always be the way it is now. And we could talk about that in a second, but your other question was, what are we?
Yeah.
And, you know, first of all, I don't know, but we are certainly the most remarkable thing in the universe. I mean, there's no question about that. And you can easily take the point of view that we are perhaps the ultimate creation of the universe, and maybe if you're going to be spiritual about it, we are the goal that the universe had. I mean, we are the most sophisticated creation in the entire universe.
We're the gem.
We're the gem. We are made of the most precious and rare ingredients We have taken the longest time to be created of anything else that we know of. And because our DNA is so difficult to replicate, there's an important consequence of that, and that is that if there is other life on other planets in the universe, I'll bet it has DNA that's a lot like ours. Because if you had, let's say, two different ways to make life, if there was DNA as one approach and there's some other approach, if that second approach was even a tenth of a percent more difficult, it would take 100 billion, billion times longer to be created.
That's a good point.
So it is so difficult to make life that if there's two ways to do it and the second way is a little tougher, that second way is never going to happen. So we know one way to make life, us, and that means that all the little green men and all those weird planets out there, they may not be as different from us as we think.
I don't think they are different at all. I think there's a lot of similarities. I think even the creatures that might be on those planets are probably pretty similar to ours. You know, I think they have ears and eyes and noses and mouths. And
I think they're all based on carbon, and they all need water. And, they all breathe oxygen probably because that's the best chemistry.
Oh, whatever the seed was, I think it's all over the place.
Yeah, maybe, yeah. So, you know, I think that's the really exciting question because, in part because we don't have the answer. And, you know, a lot of people don't like questions for which there's no answer, but scientists love them because that's what keeps us in business.
That's right. do you factor in other dimensions and other possibilities like that, other multiverses?
Well, I certainly think that there are other universes besides ours. I think that's almost essential, given what we know about cosmology.
Why can't we see it?
Oh, for several reasons. One is they're too far away, and our universe isn't old enough.
Do you think there's some kind of gap between these universes?
I think there are also probably other universes in different space and time. They have their own space-time, and we can't connect with their space-time. We can't exceed our own space-time. But the definition that scientists have for universe is something very specific. And most people, when they say universe, they think it means everything, right? But they don't have a really specific idea of what that is. But scientists have a very definite definition, and that is it's everything that we can possibly observe and everything we can possibly be influenced by. So that means it can only be those things that are close enough that something traveling at the speed of light can have reached us in the age of the universe.
Will we ever get these answers?
As to what's beyond our universe?
Well, as to everything we've talked about tonight.
I think we may discover one day more about life than we know. As far as parallel universes goes, I think we'll never know more because we will never be able to
cross
extend
over there
beyond our own. So we might have better theories, but I don't think we'll have any real data to work with.
Will there be a fluke?
A fluke?
Something will go awry, perhaps, open up a portal to another dimension, and we'll see this?
Well, that would be exciting.
It would be, absolutely.
Yeah. It'd probably be catastrophic.
For somebody.
Yeah. I mean, there are some theories that say, you know, the universes butt off each other. A new universe can be created from any spot in our universe. And in some of those scenarios, one of the universes will destroy the other one. So we might not fare so well if that happened.
Isn't that fascinating just thinking about it, though, Robert?
Yeah, I mean, the universe is a really violent place. I mean, it's hard for people to realize how much destructive energy there is in the universe. Planets can be vaporized just like that by some of these supernovas and gamma ray bursts and other things that leap out of dying stars. If the universe is a place where the temperatures can go up to billions of degrees, and we're sitting here, and, you know, if it's, as you said, if it's 10 degrees below, zero, we start to have trouble, and if it's 110, we start dying. So we're, you know, we need it to be nice and even.
How many scientists are beginning to believe what you've believed over all these years?
Well, probably very few.
Very few, yeah.
Because most of them, as I say, are doing their little thing. I mean, I'm retired, so, you know, I had more time to think about the big picture. But thinking about the big picture is not what scientists do.
Do they get ridiculed if they thought this way?
Well, you know, scientists are taught not to talk to the public, and they're taught not to speak English. So, I mean, they speak math, and they speak calculus, and they speak physics to each other. And if that's all you speak, you only talk to other scientists because that's the only people that listen to you. So that's quite an isolated group. So, you know, they don't have a very broad perspective.
What a remarkable time this would be if we can get some of these answers.
Yeah.
See,
well, we've discovered more answers in our lifetime than all previous generations of mankind put together. So we got the best shot.
I mean, religions just make it easy on themselves. They just simply say God did all this and it's done.
Mm-hmm.
Science fights it.
Well, science is based on skepticism. You know, you have to really prove what you claim. And, you know, if you believe in something and you present it at a scientific meeting, the immediate reaction of the other scientists will be to try to figure out why it's wrong.
Was Einstein a believer in a divine creator?
Einstein definitely believed in God.
He did?
Yes. Now, he was not, you know, a strict adherent to any particular religious organization. I mean, he was born Jewish, and, you know, if you asked him, he'd say he was Jewish.
Right.
But, you know, he wasn't all that excited about the organization of Jewish religion any more than he was excited about the organization of the university or the organization of any country. I mean, he was very much anti-organizations. He thought that they control people and limited human freedom and, you know, all these things that he was against. But he did believe in a divine creator of the universe. And I think he's known for, on his deathbed, his nurse asked him if he believed in God, and he was talking about the universe being a garden. And she said, well, is God the caretaker of the garden? And Einstein replied, no, God is the garden.
Well, that's a pretty good way of saying it.
Yeah, so he had a very abstract notion of God. But he definitely believed that the universe had a creator.
Did he use that because he couldn't get answers?
Well, that didn't stop him from asking questions.
Well, what's harder to say, that we were formed by a divine creator or by chance?
Well, you see, if he believed in the creator, then he wanted to know why the creator did this or why the creator did that.
Yeah.
I mean, Einstein never stopped asking questions. So it wasn't that he said that's the work of God and that's the end of it. He wanted to understand the mind of God as a devotion to him. He thought that would bring him closer to God, to understand what God had done and to see this beauty. For him, that was essentially a form of worship.
You are basically saying, though, under Can Life Be Merely an Accident, that you believe there is a God.
Well, in some sense, yeah. I mean, there has to be something. There has to be something, and I'm willing to listen to anybody's idea of what that is.
All right, let's take some questions and some ideas when we come back on Coast to Coast AM. Plus, the Skype line is open. If you do call in on Skype, which is George 97313, try to wear a headset mic if you would. We'll be back.